This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. On today's show, we'll talk with a local man who's making a 10,000-mile journey around the country by bus and writing about the people he meets along the way. Joining me first is former Labor Secretary Robert Reich. He is Chancellor's Professor of Public Policy at the Richard and Rhoda Goldman School of Public Policy at the University of California, Berkeley. He's also a senior fellow at the Blum Center for Developing Economies. His new book is Saving Capitalism: For the Many, Not the Few. In the book, he looks at how the economic system that made America so strong is now failing us and what it will take to fix it. And Bob, thank you for joining us today.
Well, Mark, thank you very much for having me on.
Now, some would argue that capitalism creates a lot of prosperity and it continues to do so. So why does capitalism need to be fixed? What is it that needs to be saved?
Well, the problem is that most people's wages are going down if you adjust for inflation. And a lot of people still don't have jobs, even at this point in the recovery. Many people are working two jobs instead of one, and they're still not making ends meet. And two-thirds of Americans are living paycheck to paycheck. So the economy is working for an elite at the top who are doing better and better. They're getting most of the wealth, most of the income. But most Americans are not doing well. So the system is not really working as it should.
What about the idea of a free market? Won't a free market take care of a lot of these problems that we see?
One of the big myths that I deal with in the book is that there is something called a free market that exists somehow out there separate from government. And the reality is that government sets the rules. There's no market in nature. The free market, in terms of what is property and contract and liability and all of the rules that we take for granted, which are very much up for grabs. Actually, those rules are changing fairly constantly. They're changing because judges and administrative agencies and also legislators are constantly revising those rules. So the big question that I really suggest people focus on is not so much free market versus government, because, again, you can't have a free market without government. The real question that is hidden behind that choice is whether we have a system that is working for most people or a system that is working for the few. And unfortunately, right now, our system is working for a very, very few at the top.
Well, give me a comparison. How is today's capitalism different than, say, the capitalism that existed in the 1950s?
Well, when I was growing up in the 1950s, one wage earner could earn enough, and many wage earners did earn enough, to support their families, have two cars, have a decent standard of living, have a home, two bedrooms. We were not rich. My father had a little clothing store downtown, but he earned enough to support his family. These days, you need two wage earners in most families, and even with two wage earners, most people barely make it. In those days, in the 1950s, the CEOs of big companies earned about 20 times what their average workers earned. Today, the CEOs of big companies are earning 300 times what average workers are earning. Then, in those days, the banks were local and they invested in your communities and our communities. Now, the banks are mostly national or global, and they take the money out of communities and they send it around the world. So we have a very different economy today, and one that is rigged in many ways against average working people and the poor.
So can you put a time frame on when these problems started, when capitalism broke, and what were some of the things that caused it to break?
In the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, things were, in many ways, not for everybody, but in many ways, things were getting better for most people. And then in the late 1970s, early 1980s, we took a giant U-turn as a country. We didn't know it at the time. I mean, most of us were continuing to do what we normally do. And the U-turn happened because of globalization and also technological change and also politics that came to be dominated more and more by people who had a great deal of wealth and a great deal of income. And as a result, a great deal of political power, they could rig the game to their own benefit.
So you're saying that the capitalism today is rigged. But what's some of the evidence that you've seen of that?
Well, for example, we are paying more for pharmaceuticals that we use than any other advanced nation citizens are paying for their pharmaceuticals. Or take Internet service. I mean, we pay more for Internet service than any citizens of any other advanced country, and we get slower Internet service. Or look at food. I mean, we are dominated by some big agricultural monopolies. That means our food is very often more expensive and of lower quality, even though we still have a lot of family farmers. The family farmers aren't the ones who are benefiting from all of the price supports and all of the subsidies going to food. And I could go on and on and on. I mean, airlines, another good example. People ask me, well, why is it that my airline ticket is still costing a lot, even though fuel prices have gone way down? Well, the answer is we no longer have much competition. 15 years ago, we had 9 major airlines. Now we're down to 4 major airlines. And in most hubs, there is only 1 or 2 major airlines. So that means not much competition. So we pay through the nose. And finally, let me just talk about banking for a second, because the 5 biggest banks on Wall Street in 1990 had 25% of all the nation's banking assets. And now, 2015, they have 44% of all the nation's banking assets. Well, you know, the bigger banks are so big, they're too big to fail. That's another upward redistribution from us to them.
When you talk about capitalism being rigged, are you talking about cronyism as opposed to true capitalism?
Yes, it is crony capitalism in the sense that the people who are making the rules of the game, legislators and also administrative agencies and even a lot of judges, are not having the public in mind when they're designing these rules and revising the rules. They're doing it with the interests of very wealthy people, very big corporations, very big Wall Street banks in mind, because those big corporations and big banks and wealthy people are providing the funding for the political campaigns, are promising good jobs, are actually making the system work for them, but not for average people and the poor.
And what about the idea, Bob, that America is a meritocracy, that you can move ahead on the basis of your own abilities and efforts? What's happened to that? Doesn't that concept still exist?
Well, it still exists to some extent, but increasingly what you're paid is really not a reflection of your worth in any moral sense. I mean, look at a hedge fund manager who gets $1 billion a year, and some of them are pulling in $1 billion a year. Now, think about it, $1 billion a year for one hedge fund manager. Why? Because the rules about trading inside information are so loose that among Wall Street hedge fund managers, you know, they're basically taking advantage of the confidential information. They know they can make bets and make a huge amount of money. Or take a CEO of a big fast food company. I won't name any names, but there's one CEO I know, one of the biggest fast food companies, who's earning $9,000 an hour while his workers are earning about $7.50 on average an hour. Well, this is not about worth. I mean, there's nobody who's worth $9,000 an hour. I'm sorry. And if you have somebody who's barely making it, you have now in the United States huge numbers of people who are called the working poor. We never used to have them before. When I grew up in the 50s and 60s, there were people who were poor, but generally they didn't work. They were disabled or they were unable to work for some other reason. Now we've got a very large number of people who are working full time or 60 hours a week or 70 hours a week, and yet they are still poor because they're not paid enough.
I take it you would support raising the minimum wage. What do you think, though, of the argument that says if you raise the minimum wage, that it's going to actually reduce the jobs that are available?
Well, I understand that argument, and I suppose that would be true if you raise the minimum wage to $20 an hour or $30 an hour. But if you raise it to in the order of $13 to $15 an hour, we know it's not going to have negative employment effects, because we look at the places around the country that have already done that, and not only do they have as many jobs as they had before, they have more jobs than they had before. How can that be? Because you see, when you put more money into people's pockets, people who are going to spend that money, they turn around and they create more jobs because there's more customers for businesses. You know, one of the biggest fallacies we deal in America or have accepted is that somehow it is the CEOs or the people at the top who make jobs, who are the job creators. That's wrong. The job creators are customers. And if you have a large and growing middle class and lower middle class, working class and poor, who have more money in their pockets to turn around and buy stuff, that means that companies are going to have an incentive to create more jobs.
Yeah, you know, you talked about the rise of the working poor. You also talk about, conversely, the rise of the non-working rich. So where does the middle class fit into all this?
Well, the problem for the middle class in America right now is that most people are sliding. They're not doing better. If you adjust for inflation, most people in the middle class are under a great deal of stress. They're worried that their children are not going to live as well as they do. The middle class, by most measures, is shrinking. And yet you've got the growth of the working poor, and then you also have, at the other end, not nearly as large a group, the growth of people who are non-working because they're heirs of great fortunes, and they are enormously rich. I mean, I don't want to pick on anybody, but the heirs to the Walmart fortune, you know, the Walton kids and their kids have more wealth than the bottom 40% of Americans put together. Well, this just doesn't make sense. This flies in the face of our basic moral ideas about how our economy ought to be working.
Now, the question is, why save capitalism as opposed to just, if it has so many problems and it's broken, why save it as opposed to just moving into another economic system?
Well, we don't really have another economic system that works. Even Denmark and Sweden and the so-called social democratic countries are still basically capitalist. Communist China, they call themselves communists, but what? There's more and more private property, private exchange contracts. It looks more and more capitalist. So we don't really have a system, an ism, that works better than capitalism, but we have a lot of different kinds of capitalism. In this country, in the United States, every 30 or 40 years, we reform capitalism. We basically roll up our sleeves, put ideology aside. We say we don't care whether we're conservatives or liberals or Democrats or whatever we are, Republicans. We are seeing the problem. We understand we've got to make sure capitalism and our economic system works for everybody rather than fewer few at the top. And we also have to make sure our democracy is not overrun by big money. And we do it. We did it between 1901 and 1916. We had to do it again in the 1930s. We did it to some extent in the 1960s in terms of civil rights and voting rights and Medicare and Medicaid. And now we have to do it again.
I'm talking with Robert Reich. His new book is Saving Capitalism for the Many, Not the Few. And some people might make the argument, you might hear this said, that government intrudes on the free market system, but you're saying government has a role. How so?
Well, government is the free market system. Without government, there would be no free market. Even the basic building blocks like property. I mean, what is property? Well, today's property, most of it in the most valuable form of property, is called intellectual property. That's patents and trademarks. Now, who creates patents and trademarks? Well, the government decides what is going to be patentable and for how long. One of the reasons that pharmaceuticals cost so much in the United States is that pharmaceutical companies are paying off what are called generic producers of pharmaceuticals who want to produce pharmaceuticals when the patent period is over, but the big patent companies, the big pharmaceutical proprietary companies, are paying the generics to delay the introduction of their generic versions of those products, which means we all pay more. Now, that's government making that decision. Most other countries, that is not allowed. That is illegal, pay for delay. In this country, it is legal. So the whole system, whether you're talking about patents and private property in terms of intellectual property, or you're talking about bankruptcy, which, you know, you can, if you're a big company, you can declare bankruptcy. And if you're very rich, you can declare bankruptcy and you can reorganize your debts. If you are a homeowner and you are underwater and you can't pay your mortgage, or if you are a former student with student debts, you can't use bankruptcy. Now, that's because the credit card industry and the big creditors and the banks have organized bankruptcy to benefit them and the big corporations, but not to benefit the rest of us.
Go back to patents for just a second. Do you think the American people should have a share in patents?
Yes, I do. I think that as more and more technology displaces more and more jobs, and as we see technologies gradually replacing more and more work, what we ought to do is have a share, a small share. The public ought to have a small share of the revenues from all patents. And what that would do is it would enable us to have a kind of minimum basic income. I don't think that minimum basic income should be very high, but eventually we're going to be at a point where robots are doing everything. And if there's not a way to have a minimum basic income and at least support ourselves through, as I said, a small, maybe 20% of all patent revenues, then who's going to buy anything? We won't have an economy that's functional. We'll have the robots doing everything, which would be nice, but nobody's going to be able to afford to have their own robot.
So you back the idea of paying all Americans a guaranteed income of some type, then, I take it?
Yeah, minimum guaranteed income. Again, not very high. It wouldn't be a replacement for work. People would still have to do some work for a living in order to have a good life, but we wouldn't have a situation, the kind of situation we're heading toward, where machines are taking over, and I'm talking about software and automated machines and complex internet-enabled machines and robots are going to take over so much work that there's not going to be enough good work left for most Americans.
Now, how do you propose we go about saving capitalism?
Well, we save capitalism because, and again, if you follow my argument, this is really more of a political problem than an economic problem. We need to have countervailing power in America. People who are losing their jobs, people who are paid very little, people who are working class but on the verge of being poor, people who are small businesses and small farmers. We need to join together and really express our countervailing power against the big corporations and the big banks on Wall Street and the billionaires that are basically running the economy and our democracy right now.
Are unions part of the countervailing power?
I'm sorry?
Are unions part of the countervailing power? I mean, we've seen a decline in the countervailing in that aspect over the years.
In the 1950s and 1960s, we did have countervailing power, and not just unions. And a third of all private sector workers were in unions. Now it's only fewer than 7% of private sector workers in unions. But we also had farm cooperatives balancing out big agriculture. We had local banks balancing out the big Wall Street banks. We had small businesses that were protected from the big chains and the big box retailers. You don't have that kind of countervailing power in America anymore. Unions, ranks are decimated. Small businesses are really being driven out by the big box retailers. Small farmers are having a harder and harder time dealing with factory farmers and the monopolists who are running agriculture now, the big agricultural commodities. You have big banks, Wall Street banks, driving out the community banks. Well, in all these areas, we have to fight back. And I don't mean literally fight back, but I think that politically, Americans have to join together.
What would be the cost of saving capitalism? How difficult a task would that be?
Well, it definitely is a political challenge, because we've had so many years in which so many people have basically become cynical about politics. And cynicism is a self-fulfilling prophecy, because if we think that the game is indubitably and inevitably loaded and fixed and will not be working for us, if we think that politics is just never going to work and our democracy is just impossibly fixed by the rich and by the big corporations, and if we feel, therefore, that our economy is not working, then we're never going to be able to save it, because, you see, it's going to be a self-fulfilling prophecy. Anybody who gives up completely on politics is giving up on our democracy. And if you give up on our democracy, you're allowing the moneyed interests to take over everything.
Now, on the flip side, what do you think the costs are if we don't fix the system?
Well, the costs are huge. The trend over the last 30 years has been, for most Americans, stagnant wages or declining wages. And for a huge number of Americans, they see that their children are not living as well as they. Even college graduates are now facing declining wages, while people at the top have never had it so good in terms of a huge portion of the wealth and income in this country that in turn they use to fix politics. I mean, they are pouring huge amounts of money into political campaigns and lobbying, so they get rules in the market that are biased in favor of them. We can't go on like this. This is not sustainable. We're going to have an economy that just can't function because there's not enough purchasing power in the middle class, the working class, and the poor to keep the economy going. And also, people are going to get so frustrated and angry that they are either going to rise up and reform the system, or they're going to rise up and follow some demagogue who's blaming, I don't know, blame. You pick your target of blame, scapegoating others. We've seen it in history.
You're talking about this being a political issue and that people are frustrated. Are we seeing all this reflected in the current presidential cycle?
Well, you're certainly seeing an upsurge of what might be called populism. That is, the public that says, we don't want the standard ruling class, the business as usual, politics as usual. We want something very, very different. Some people are very attracted to Bernie Sanders. Some people are very attracted to Donald Trump. I think that they're very different kinds of people representing very different sides of populism. But undoubtedly, there is something new going on.
Well, how confident are you that capitalism can be fixed?
I don't think we have any choice. And I am confident if you look at history, whether it's the 1830s when reformers decided that it wasn't capitalism that was wrong, but we were creating an aristocracy, and we had to make sure that our economic system did not allow a permanent aristocracy. Or, again, between 1901 and 1916, when we said, no, the Gilded Age with the robber barons and the monopolies, we can't have that, and we reformed the system. The 1930s, under the New Deal, Franklin D. Roosevelt, again, a period of dramatic and fundamental reform to make the system work for everyone, at least for a while. And then, again, at least to some extent in the 1960s, with voting rights and civil rights and Medicare and eventually the Environmental Protection Act in 1970. Well, we do, again, as Americans, we are not ideological. We don't succumb to communism or to fascism, as some other countries have in times of economic stress. We roll up our sleeves. We do what needs to be done. I am absolutely confident that we will opt for reform eventually. But the question is how much time has to pass and how much damage has to be done before we do.
Bob, good talking to you this afternoon.
Mark, it's great talking to you.
Robert Reich, Chancellor's Professor of Public Policy at the Richard and Rhoda Goldman School of Public Policy at the University of California, Berkeley. He's also a senior fellow at the Blum Center for Developing Economies. His new book is Saving Capitalism for the Many, Not the Few, and he has a book signing this evening at 7 at Joseph Beth Booksellers in Norwood. Up next, we'll talk with local writer Doug Spack about his journey around the U.S. and hear some of the stories of the people he's met so far. This is Cincinnati Edition. Thanks to Sue Seri for listening to 91.7 WVXU today.